Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. We are all familiar with the medical challenges of major diseases such as cancer and heart disease, but what about so-called rare diseases? A rare disease is defined as one that generally afflicts fewer than 200,000 people. Add to that the fact that there are some 7,000 people who suffer from one or more of them. That's 30 million Americans, and it's not difficult to imagine medical science's challenges in research and treatment. In all likelihood, most of us have probably never heard of many of these diseases. I'm Don Marsh. Rare diseases is our subject on today's program. A little bit later, we'll be talking with families and victims of such diseases and with representatives from Washington and St. Louis universities who are involved in research. But we begin with Mary Dunkel, Vice President of Communications for NORD. That's the National Organization for Rare Disorders, which advocates for victims of rare diseases and for access to diagnostics and therapies for them. She joins us by phone from Danbury, Connecticut. Mary, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Don, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. We have a couple of minutes together. Mary, is it fair to say that rare diseases are really second-class citizens when it comes to research and funding?
Well, I don't know if I would use that phrasing, but certainly all of us in the rare disease community struggle to find research dollars. I think something like 12% of the National Institutes of Health budget goes to rare diseases. So, you know, we certainly appreciate the fact that the greatest share of the money needs to go to the diseases affecting the most people, but we also are constantly in there fighting to make sure that these diseases and the people affected by them are not forgotten.
What sort of an impact is that having on research and your funding?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting time, and this is certainly a timely topic because this year marks the 30th anniversary of the Orphan Drug Act, which was a piece of legislation that created financial incentives to make it possible for pharmaceutical companies to do the research they need to do to develop treatments for these rare diseases. That law has been very successful, and NORD actually was formed by patient advocates who worked to get that law passed back in 1983. It's also an interesting time because there's a lot of really good progress being made on the scientific front, and researchers like the ones that you'll be talking to today are doing some wonderful work. And one of the other really exciting things that's happening right now is the role that patients and patient organizations are playing in supporting research. Through our organization, NORD, and through many wonderful organizations for specific rare disease communities, people are really doing some great fundraising. They're funding, providing grants and funding some really important research. And then when those early small studies produce good results, there may be larger funding later from the federal government or even from industry.
Which is something, obviously, that you're very, very hopeful about, I'm sure. Tell me, if you would, about the role of the pharmaceutical industry here. You know, I think we're all familiar with the fact that the big pharma likes to produce products that will be applied to diseases that so many more people suffer from. I suspect that they're not playing such a big role in these rare diseases.
Well, they're playing a growing role. There actually has been quite a bit written just within the past few years about a sort of, I don't know if explosion is too dramatic a word to use, but certainly a broadening of interest among pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies in developing products for these rare diseases. So we're seeing a lot of good activity on that front. And I think, you know, in the early days of NORD, and even over my years here, I've been with NORD for going on 15 years now. And several years ago, it was mostly very small, mostly biotech companies who were interested in working with these diseases. And now we really are seeing a lot of the larger, more established pharmaceutical companies developing special rare disease units. And they've seen these small companies show that it can be a viable business model. So they're turning their attention to the rare diseases, too. And we think that's great. We welcome everybody.
And how about the insurance companies?
Well, the insurance companies, there are challenges, of course, but NORD works on initiatives such as patient assistance programs to try to assure that if a treatment is developed, every patient who needs that treatment will have access to it, because rare diseases on the whole are very serious diseases. In many cases, they're life-threatening or life-shortening diseases, and obviously making sure that patients have access to treatments is a very important part of the process. There's still many challenges on that front, but we feel that progress is being made.
What are the most perplexing diseases out there with which you're familiar?
Oh, my goodness. That's a tough question, because
there are only 7,000 of them.
I know. As you mentioned, there are 7,000 diseases that, and they actually, for anybody who's interested in reading about them, they're all listed on the website of the National Institutes of Health has an Office of Rare Diseases Research. So if you just search on NIH ORDR, you can read about all 7,000 diseases. And I think one of the characteristics is that they tend to be, I don't know if interesting is the right word to use, but they are very interesting and often very complex diseases. It's very, very challenging for patients to be able to get an accurate, timely diagnosis. That's certainly one of the problems, and that continues to be a problem today, even for some of these diseases that are better known. And that's not a criticism of physicians. You can just imagine the challenge with 7,000 diseases. In many cases, they may be diseases that an individual physician would see at most, once in a career. So for especially physicians on the front lines, the pediatricians and family physicians and people who might be the first to catch these, it's really a challenge to be aware of all of them and know what to look for.
We have to put a bottom line on this. Just in conclusion, I gather from what you're saying that progress, at least from NORD's point of view, over the past 30 years has been consistent but slow.
Yes, that's true. But I think the pace is picking up. We feel that we see some really great activity in the research. The FDA, for its part, is looking at its procedures. There was some really important legislation passed just this last year in 2012 called the FDA Safety and Innovation Act that really will provide some great new measures in the review of treatments for rare diseases. And just in general, I think, there are some wonderful patient organizations out there. If people are having trouble finding an organization for their disease, they can go to NORD's website and search a database there. And we encourage people to connect with others, that it helps in so many ways.
We'll put a link to that website on ours at stlpublicradio.org. I have not yet introduced our other guests who will be appearing after you leave, Mary, but I think one of them, Dr. Guttman, had something he wanted to say in response to something you said.
Thank you, Don. I think we're living in an incredibly exciting time. I've been involved in genetic research for 20 years now and have witnessed an explosion in the way we take care of people with this condition that I work on, which is neurofibromatosis, or NF. We've gone in a mere 20-some-odd years from not understanding why people actually have the condition to finding the causative genes, to finding new medicines that work specifically for people who have particular problems with NF, to developing clinical trials consortium to uniformly test drugs to prove that they work. This is breathtaking in 20 years how much we've changed the landscape for this one condition. And, I would say that the excitement that I feel from what I've witnessed in the last 20 years is immediately translatable to the general population. What we learn from studying conditions like neurofibromatosis has great impact for other conditions. Kids who have NF1 may have problems with autistic-like behaviors, learning problems, cancers. And what we learn by studying a single gene disorder like NF1 teaches us so much about other problems that occur in far more many people in the general population.
Well, Mary Dunkel, there's a confirmation of some of the things that you've said. I want to thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with NORD.
Thank you very much, Don.
That's Mary Dunkel, Vice President of Communications, or NORD, the National Organization for Rare Disorders. We turn now to our in-studio guests. Joining me are Dr. David Gutman, from whom you just heard. He's Director of Neurofibromatosis Center at Washington University. I'll be calling it NF from now on, by the way, for obvious reasons. He's at Washington University and professor in the Department of Neurobiology. He's considered an international expert on NF. Pete Rominski is Executive Director at the Center for World Health and Medicine at St. Louis University. The goal of the center is to find treatments and cures for diseases that are rare or neglected. Also with me in studio for a bit is Dolores Rucker. She is the mother of two children who have sickle cell disease. Thank you all so much for being with us. Well, Doctor, you've just had an opportunity to tell us a little something about what you're doing in NF. Let me turn now to you, sir, and ask what you're doing over at St. Louis University.
Yeah, so we turned a actual something that was kind of a negative. My whole team came from a large pharmaceutical company here in town, and when they kind of closed things down, consolidation and all that, we approached St. Louis University to capture a team of us, drug scientists, and to embed ourselves in with basic researchers and to redeploy our skills targeting these kind of diseases that pharma companies typically haven't paid a lot of attention to in the past.
Is it for the reason that I suggested, is there just not that large a market to make it worth their while?
I think in the past that's true, but as Mary had alluded to, that's starting to pick up. I think they're realizing that the pipeline is kind of drying up. There's generic drug competition. So I think they're getting more interested. And so our team really looks at the kind of basic research that underlies the mechanisms of some of these rare diseases. And what our goal is to take our knowledge of how to translate those things into a potential drug and to ideally we'd like to then present it to pharmaceutical companies. So we've kind of done all the legwork to them. And I think if we can do that, I think then there's going to be an uptick in moving these things forward.
What are some of the diseases that you're looking at?
So I'd say in the rare disease area, the three that we're looking at is sickle cell disease. And actually, because of the knowledge we have of some of the mechanisms of it and our knowledge of clinical drug candidates, we actually are going to do a clinical trial at Cardinal Glennon Hospital with a drug that is currently used in a cardiovascular setting for angioplasty surgery. But we think the mechanisms of how that drug works may be important to patients that come in to Cardinal Glennon and other children's hospital with something called sickle cell crises. And Dolores can expound upon that, but it's very painful, and it's an occlusion that is caused by these sickled cells. And every time that happens, it damages the organ a little bit on the other end of that occlusion. And we feel that this drug has an opportunity to perhaps minimize this occlusion and get them out of the hospital quicker and minimize the effects of this. And if it turns out that this shows promise, it could be a new therapy for these patients.
Dolores, I'm sure that comes as very good news to you. If you will, tell me what you're experiencing as a mother and what your children are experiencing, both of whom suffer from this disease.
I'm experiencing, it's a lot of different ways to experience, to look at it. It's one of the things as far as getting an understanding of what it is that your kids are going through, because it's basically like you're learning from them. You're learning from everything. I'm experiencing the ups and the downs of it. Some of the pros of it is just the fact of coming to know different people in the community that really, to make it aware. Sickle cell disease is one of those things that is not a lot people don't know about it. You know, it's not a big awareness of it. You know, it's one of those things that you really don't know about until you're faced with it at home. Again, I have a 10-year-old and a 9-year-old that has it. Well, an 8-year-old is turning 9 that has it. My 10-year-old, they have the same exact thing, which is sickle cell CSC disease, which is supposed to be like on the low grade of it. However, he has a lot of the, my 10-year-old has a lot of the symptoms of a SS patient, which is frequent pain crises, as he, you know, noted. He has to get blood therapy, which is blood transfusions, every month. We've had everything as far as the hand and feet crisis, like we've had sickle cell crisis everywhere. It's one of those things that it's basically a blood disorder, and basically you can have a sickle cell crisis everywhere that the blood travels, which is through throughout your body. As a parent, it's one of those things that you want to try to take away from your kids, but you can't. You know, and just try to, in one of those things that a lot of people may take for granted, something as simple as going out and playing in the snow or going out on a hot summer day. Well, sickle cell kids is not allowed to do that, you know, because of they can't be in cold weathers and they can't be in, you know, too hot weather. So what we do as, you know, as a family is that we do bring the cold inside. So we'll do like snowball fights and things of that nature inside our home, and just to let them know that, you know, this is something that, you know, you have sickle cell. Sickle cell don't have you, and that's like our motto, and that's how we try to live with it.
How are they handling it?
My 10-year-old, see, he's getting older, and so where it's one of those things, so where it's beginning to become challenging to him, because I went with it as far as the older they got was what, you know, I gave them little by little information, you know, until I felt like they was old enough to, you know, to understand it better. My 10-year-old, he's one of those, he's really getting, basically, I can say sick of it, like he... like, oh, I have to go to the doctor again. And, you know, well, with my 8-year-old, to her, it's like, I'm going to the doctor. So it's a different aspect from both of them. My 10-year-old, he has it worse, to where he's been in the hospital more, and he has things going on with his body more than what she does. So it's kind of challenging more for him than it is for her.
Pete Ruminski, what kind of hope can we give these kids at this point?
So I think the first thing is we didn't go in saying we're going to look at sickle cell disease. I think it was we like I said before, we have a lot of knowledge of different mechanisms of disease and drugs that treat different mechanisms. And when we came across this for sickle cell disease, we kind of linked the two up. So it wasn't like we said, oh, we're going to work on this and we know nothing about it. It was kind of matching up two things. And so I think that if this were to actually show benefit in this small clinical trial that we're doing now, it could expand and be a therapy. However, it may not work because drug discovery is very, very difficult. And so that's why as Mary alluded, funding is very hard to get. But we're trying to have a funding campaign where we would bring in a war chest of money in a kind of a sickle cell bank account. And our goal would be is if this didn't work, we'll look for something else. And we'll look for something else until we do find something.
I have to take a break, and we're going to have other guests in studio to talk about NF1 in just a moment. But I saw something in the paper last week about a young lady here mm-hmm. in St. Louis. And she had sickle cell, mm-hmm. and apparently the prognosis is terrific for her now after some stem cell work.
Right.
What's going on there?
So I think that that's great, except that it is a very risky procedure, and most physicians that work with these sickle cell patients will say it's very risky. It's also very costly. And so I think that it's going to be out of reach for a lot of patients. And because of the risk factors, I think you're going to be very selective who could be appropriate for this. And that doesn't help the other 80, 90% that would not be appropriate.
Sure.
So our goal is to find something that would be more applicable to everybody.
Right. Well, we certainly hope you do that. And Dolores, I know you're hoping for that, and
yes,
we're hoping
I am.
For you as
yeah,
well.
I'm for the best.
Thank you so much for being with us and telling us your story. We have to take a break now. We'll do that. I'm talking to Dolores Rucker. She's the mother of two children with sickle cell disease. Also with me in studio is Dr. David Gutman, a director of the Neurofibromatosis Center at Washington University, and Pete Rominski is executive director at the Center for World Health and Medicine at St. Louis University. We'll take that break now and come back and continue the conversation on rare diseases in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on rare diseases and the work that's being done to try to deal with them. There are so many of them, more than 7,000 as I understand it, and obviously that involves a lot of research in a lot of places and spreading the dollars that are available around in a rather thin way because there aren't so many dollars out there. My guest in studio, Dr. David Gutman, director of Neurofibromatosis Center at Washington University. Pete Rominski is executive director at the Center for World Health and Medicine at St. Louis University. And we are joined in studio now by Frances Wersch, the mother of a daughter who has NF1, that's neurofibromatosis, and she herself is afflicted with it. Allison Wersch is also with us in studio. Ladies and lady, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I had to notice that when you two came into the studio that you all had a big hug for Dr. Gutman.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess you know each other fairly well. Tell us what's going on with this family, Dr. Gutman.
Absolutely. So I've known Allison since she was 1 year old, I think.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So it's been a journey together, and I think we've learned. I think I've learned as much from Allison as she's probably learned from me, because there's a tremendous partnership between our families and ourselves. In fact, they're the ones that drive the research that happens both in the basic science laboratories and in the clinic.
The ladies are from Bethalto, Illinois, and I should point out that Allison, you're a high school sophomore. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And vice president of your class.
Yes, sophomore class.
All right. Dr. Gutman, back to you with regard to NF1 and Allison and Frances. Mother and daughter, is this unusual?
Not at all. About half of the time, it runs in families. So we see a father and a son, a mother and a daughter, mother and a son. And about half the time, it appears for the first time in a family without an affected family member.
And how does it present in their case?
So typically what we see is that we see a young child sometime in the first few months of life who has birthmarks, just kind of the birthmarks that you and I might have. But instead of having one, they'll have half a dozen. And that's a very big clue to pediatricians and nurses that they need to think about neurofibromatosis type 1. And that's actually when I met Allison, when she showed up and had more than her dose of cafe au lait spots or birthmarks. Mm-hmm.
Allison, let me turn to you and ask what life is like for someone who's obviously an active teenager. What is life like dealing with NF1?
Well, I've always known I was different and I wasn't like any other kids, but I figure I could make the best of that situation and improve upon it all and just get myself involved and try not to think about what things might happen.
Mm-hmm. And how are you doing in dealing with that?
I'm doing pretty well. I have a really good support system, and I'm really thankful for that. And I think that's really all you need is a really good support system to know that you can go through it, and as long as someone's there for you, it makes the process better.
Well, the doctor talked about early presentation of birthmarks, if you will. What about now? What are there symptoms? What are you dealing with?
Well, right now, it's not that big of a deal for me right now. I'm kind of growing just with it, and I still have present birthmarks that have remained on me to this day since I was born.
Frances, and your situation, tell us about you as the mother of someone with NF1 and the fact that you have it yourself.
Well, it was unusual how I found it. My son has cerebral palsy, so when my daughter was born, the first birthmark appeared on her thigh. She was in the incubator, and I knew immediately that she had NF. So I found Dr. Gutman on a Channel 4 news late at night. Mm-hmm. And I called him, and we got in immediately, and they found a optic pathway glioma. And we waited 3 months, and it had grown. They're slow-growing tumors. And then we waited for, and then once we waited 3 months from there, it grew, and then we proceeded from there.
I'm gathering and making an assumption. This is a tumor affecting the eye somehow?
So it's a tumor that affects the nerve that carries vision from the eye to the brain. Mm-hmm. And kids where it continues to grow can cause them to lose vision.
Any problems with you in that regard, Alice?
I did have some trouble with my peripheral vision earlier this year, but I took a test and I'm improving. So I'm very thankful.
And Francis, how about you?
I've just been afflicted with mostly just the small tumors. I have a very mild form of it. And Allison has something a little more challenging. She had the tumor in the brain. I do not have it. I had an MRI. So each individual person with this disease, it's an individual disease. Everyone is treated individually. So,
Doctor, how do you treat a tumor in the brain?
So that's a great question, because the way we typically treat brain tumors is to borrow from brain tumor treatments for people without NF1. And that's not individualizing or personalizing care. That's simply borrowing from what we do in the general population. While that's sometimes successful, it's not proven always successful in our kids with NF1. And that's forced us to really focus both in the laboratory and the clinic to find better treatments. And much as Pete brought up and Mary from NORD brought up, one of our challenges is to really unravel the genetic basis and the biochemical basis for the conditions for the optic gliomas to find drugs that actually work. And one of the drugs happened to be a drug that was used to prevent the rejection of a kidney transplant, and work in my lab and in the center helped to identify that was the right drug to use. And it's now in clinical trials for kids who show up, like Allison, who need to have their tumor treated.
Pete Rominski, I get the impression, and you're someone who was formerly in the drug industry,
yes,
that a lot of the progress is serendipitous, that you find things that were designed for something else, and lo and behold, they work in something like a rare disease.
That's exactly right. And I think there's a lot of scientists who would look at that and frown upon it because they think we, you know, can design everything. And there's certainly a place for that. But I brought up on, you know, serendipity is for those that are trained to see something that can be applied to something else. And that's not only in the drug world. Nylon and everything else was discovered accidentally by looking for something else. And I think if you are trained, as we are, to look and say, are there things out there that can be reapplied towards something else, then absolutely.
Doctor, how did you get into this? I mean, this is – someone said that this NF1 neurofibromatosis is probably the disease that no one has ever heard of, and it's right. Probably the most unheard of disease, if you will.
Right. So it actually suffers from two of these kinds of problems. One is that it's one of the most common disorders you've never heard
that's
of.
That's what I was
and
trying to say.
And the other is that if you've heard of it, you've heard of it in the context of the Elephant Man, which is not neurofibromatosis type 1. So even if you've heard of it, you've probably heard of something that it is not. So we do fight that battle in terms of raising awareness.
How much?
So how did I get into it?
Yeah, right.
So I got into it many years ago as a graduate student. I was working in a department where the chair was the first person to recognize that this was a genetic condition. And he was the one who got me interested in the genetics of neurologic disorders. And when I was a postgraduate trainee, I joined the laboratory of Francis Collins. And one of the genes that Francis was working on was the NF1 gene. And he said to me, "You're a neurologist. This would be the perfect condition for you to study." And I said, "Well, I'd love to." And it's been a love affair for 20 some odd years.
Francis, let me ask you, and then Allison as well, how do you work with Dr. Gutman and his team?
They're a great team. It's like family.
I'm sure they are, but what is the interaction like? I'm sure you see each other with some regularity.
Oh, it's not even like going into a clinical doctor. You know, when you go in and a handshake and how are you? It's how are you and how's your dog? And you know what I mean? It's he knows everything about Allison, and it's just a friendly, warm place to go into. They make you feel like you're going to survive this. We're all family. We're all going to work through this together. You know, Is that that's the way that that I've taught my daughter and how she her outlook on it is too.
And how often, Allison, do you see Dr. Gutman?
Once or twice a year.
And what goes on when you see him?
Well, I usually go into the clinic and wait a long time, and then and then I will.
He is a doctor after all. We know how that works.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I'll go into the waiting room, and then a nurse will usually come in and see me, and then Dr. Gutman will come in, and it's just like home to me.
And what happens there once he comes in? I mean, is it a consultation? Is there an examination that's involved?
Well, slightly, but I wouldn't really call it that because I'm so used to it now. I mean, it's like the schedule that I'm on when I go in there. And, yeah, they do check me for things, but everything ends up going well.
You tell me from your perspective, doctor, what goes on? What are you looking for when Allison comes in?
So there are lots of things that we look for, and they depend on the age of the child. So when Allison was very little, we were very focused on her development. We were very focused on her eyesight. As she got older, we started to talk about the lumps and bumps, the benign tumors that Mrs. Wersch was talking about, the neurofibromas. We talk about issues of disclosure, when to tell people. It's really very age-dependent, and we need to work with Allison to empower her to be able to be her own advocate, and she's an outstanding advocate.
Allison, do you have a fear of NF1? I mean, are you fearful that it will do something to you at some point that you really don't want to happen?
Well, I feel like anyone with NF1 can be fearful. I mean, my mom just had a tumor growing on her last year, and it was really struggling. And I know that I've already had a tumor on my brain, and I went through chemotherapy for it. So, of course, there's always a worry in the back of my mind, but I know that I have such a great team that I really don't have to worry about it.
Doctor, are these tumors malignant?
So the majority of the tumors are benign, but people with NF1 can have malignant tumors. We don't see them nearly as frequently.
And once or twice a year is often enough to really keep track of all of this.
Right. I mean, if there were something that we were specifically monitoring, like in the old days when we were worried about Allison's vision, she was seen every 3 months, and she had an eye exam, and we did MRI scans of her brain and her optic nerves, and we saw her, and we were right on top of her.
We see the eye doctor a lot, and we do a lot of the Humphrey Field vision tests. And so we see an eye doctor quite a bit.
Is all of this covered by insurance?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Insurance, I raised that issue with Mary earlier on. What about, Pia, I'll bring you back into the conversation. What about insurance and rare diseases?
I think that if you have a therapy that's effective, at least up until now, even drugs that can be upwards of $200,000 a year, they will cover those. But it's got to be effective. It's got to have some kind of effect. But so I think that that's the bottom line. If you have something that works,
the bottom line is the bottom line.
The bottom line is the bottom line.
But that makes the kind of work you're doing, Pete and Dr. Gutman, even more important because of the potential for saving. I'm just guessing you probably don't have $200,000 in cash, Francis.
No, I do not. No,
and most people don't, which makes your work that much more important. Right.
I would also say that in the sickle cell case, and we're working on two other rare diseases we can talk about, but in the sickle cell case, just for example, when a patient comes in for a sickle cell crisis, that's a hospital stay, and it can be 5 days, it can be up to 12 days. If we had something that actually worked when they came in and knocked that down to, a fraction of that, whatever you're paying for the drug, you're saving healthcare costs tremendously from the hospital stay, as well as the suffering of the patient.
Sure, and it's also very expensive. I have to take another break. We'll do that now. Our subject today is rare diseases. My guest in studio, Pete Ruminski, you just heard from him. He's executive director at the Center for World Health and Medicine at St. Louis University. Dr. David Gutman is the director of Neurofibromatosis Center at Washington University. Also with me in studio is Frances Wersch, mother of a daughter who has NF1, as we like to call it, because it's so much easier to say. And daughter Allison is with us in studio. Francis, by the way, also has NF1.
We'll be back to continue the conversation. I'd like to bring you in on it. If you'd like to take part in the conversation on rare diseases, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Allison, you tweet, don't you?
I'm not
surprised in that. Do you, Mom?
I do not know how to tweet.
All right. Allison can give you a lesson when we take this break. We'll be back in just a moment. Give us a call, 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We are continuing our conversation on rare diseases. But before we do continue that conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri Auditor Tom Schweik has released the results of an audit of the St. Louis Public Schools, which examines school finances, education programs, purchasing policies, and other issues. And there is a new report on hunger in Missouri showing that almost 17%, that's 17% of households, struggle with hunger issues. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now, back to our conversations with Dr. David Gutman, Pete Ruminski, and Frances Weish and her daughter, Allison. I'm going to go right to the phones because there's a call that Dr. Gutman, I think, will probably have to handle. Nancy in Chesterfield, thanks for being with us. Go ahead. Nancy? Is Nancy with us? We'll give her one more shot at it. Nancy, are you there? Okay, I'll turn to Nancy?
Yes.
Go ahead. I think we missed the first part of your comments. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Hi. My daughter Zoe is a patient of Dr. Gutman and his NF1 team. And I was wondering if he could talk about his NF1 genome initiative and the NF patient registry projects and how these models might be beneficial for other disease research approaches.
So what we're trying to do is create a community with enabling resources so that we can actually better understand this condition. And the way that we've done this is to put together a web-based international registry where folks with NF all over the world can put in information about their NF so that we can learn about patterns in NF that we would never have learned if we just focused on the families that we see in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. In addition, we've built a genome study. This is a genome project that's focused only on NF1, where we're trying to understand the kinds of questions that Frances raised, which is, why is everybody with NF different? What makes them unique? And that may have nothing to do with the NF1 gene itself. It may have to do with all the other DNA that we all carry. Our genetic material is going to be different. And understanding that is going to be the key to personalizing and individualizing treatments for folks with NF.
So you're able to cast a wider net this way. Mm-hmm. And I know, Pete Ruminski, that you wanted to make sure we talked earlier about sickle cell disease. I know you wanted to make sure that people know about ways they can contact you about that.
Right. If they're interested in the clinical trial, just to call 314-577-5638. That's 314-577-5638 for additional information.
All right. We'll get that number on our website at stlpublicradio.org a little bit later this afternoon.
Great.
Back to the phones now. We'll bring in Owen calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Owen. You're on the air. Owen, are you with us?
Hello, this is Owen, yes.
Go ahead, please.
Taking my call. I just wanted to say my niece actually has NF1 as well, and St. Louis is a great place to have, I'm not sure there's anywhere that's great to have NF, but if you have it, St. Louis is a great place to be. There's several studies going on. I know Washington University, I think SLU has one as well. The Children's Tumor Foundation is very active in the area and fundraising with their marathon clubs. And it's just, we're very lucky to be in St. Louis to have the support teams that are available here.
Owen, thanks for the call. I'm sure Dr. Gutman appreciates it as well. Dr. Gutman, is there a number? How many people in this country do you think suffer from NF1?
So it's approximately 1 in 2,500 individuals. So that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 in 20. It's about 120,000 to 130,000 individuals.
Which makes it qualify for the under 200,000 mark. How about sickle cell, Pete?
It's under 200,000. It's hard to tell because sometimes patients may may not realize that they have it. So, but it's clearly under the 200,000.
And sickle cell, and I should have brought this up when Dolores was here, but basically it affects African Americans or North people of North African descent. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's some Caribbean descent as well that's involved, but I would say in our community the majority is going to be of African American descent.
Do we know why?
Well, there's actually a evolutionary theory that says that that sickle cell disease actually evolved as a countermeasure to malaria, which is prevalent and endemic in sub-Saharan Africa. And so there was a thought that as a way to resist the malaria parasite, these sickle cells were formed and they are resistant to it. So on the one hand, they're resistant to malaria, but then, of course, then you get all of the downside effects of having sickle cell.
Well, my notes indicate that malaria is something that you're also working on. Is that
That's
right?
correct. It's so we have the rare disease, the orphan diseases we're working on, as well as neglected diseases. And the main ones there are malaria, some parasitic diseases, and childhood diarrhea, which is actually the second leading cause of death in the world, mostly in the developing world, from from various intestinal parasites and bacteria and, unsanitary conditions.
I spent some time in Somalia during the famine there, and, mm-hmm. and that was the killer.
Absolutely.
That was the killer.
Yep. So we're working on anti-secretory drugs in collaboration with One World Health Path and the Gates Foundation, which is funding some of that work. The other two orphan diseases that we're working on locally, which actually has a local connection. I don't know if you remember Charlie Spoonhour, the former Billiken basketball coach. He had pulmonary fibrosis, which is a deadly disease. Once you get it, you have about 2-3 years, and it's fatal, and there are no therapies for it. And Charlie died of – well, he actually had a lung transplant at Duke, but then died soon after that. And so we have some very promising agents that we're working on that that we're going to try to move into clinical trials for pulmonary fibrosis. And the other one, it's a tongue-twisting thing, name, fascioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy.
I'm glad you didn't ask me to say that.
Yeah, it's a subtype of muscular dystrophy. And the interesting story here is that one of our scientists, and I got to say, none of this would take place without it's an extremely dedicated, talented, and passionate team that we have using their skills that they developed in the pharmaceutical area to work on these things and the support of St. Louis University. Without that, none of this would happen. But one of our senior scientists approached me, and his daughter was recently diagnosed with this form of muscular dystrophy. And he did some research on it, and what he found is that some of the underlying causes were an area that he had expertise in. And he came to me and he said, "Do you think I could work on this part-time?" And, of course, what am I going to say? Okay. You know, this is what we're in. We're doing these things. And he's made some tremendous progress already, and hopefully he will be able to find something.
Hopefully.
Yes.
Hopefully is a word, I guess, that all of us use a lot in conjunction with this particular subject. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Richard calling from St. Louis. Richard, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
Okay. Yeah. I'm dealing with a disease that they say that there's no cure for, and they don't know where it comes from. And it's something that they don't think is genetic, but then others say it is. I'm dealing with sarcoidosis. Which is another pulmonary disease, but it also affects other organs. But that disease also caused trigeminal neuralgia, which I just found out I had.
Trigeminal neuralgia.
And then another disease which is affecting my teeth breaking up is called, I forgot the name of that one. It's a big name as well. But I'm looking at all these special diseases that's very rare. It's all hitting me, and it's kind of weird. And I'm trying to, I'm looking for studies that involve those as well. Because the sarcoidosis causes granulomas on the lungs. I just found out from my doctor there's no real medical way to find out how to cure that, or no kind of medicine that helps it at all. And so the medications that they're giving me, which is like 30-something pills, is not really doing nothing to affect the outcome of this disease.
Richard, I'm not sure we have the expertise here at the table to deal with many of the things that you unfortunately are dealing with. But perhaps Dr. Gutman and Pete, is there some place we can send Richard to perhaps get a little help and learn more about what he's dealing with?
I think Mary brought that up originally, which is to go to the National Institutes of Health Office of Rare Disease Research website that lists all the rare disorders and will direct people to the patient support groups and the research that's going on. That might be a good place to start.
Richard, can you do that?
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. I guess one of the things I want to keep coming back to is the issue of funding. Where does the funding come from in the work that you're doing? Is it coming from government? Is it coming from private sources? Coming from pharmaceutical industry? Where is it coming? I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think that from the understanding the underlying disease, the basic research that goes on, I would say, and Dave, you can chime in, but I think that comes from the typical sources, the NIH and things like that. The translational part is the tough part because, you know, pharma companies, traditionally, you've got to have something that's ready for them. So we're in that kind of valley of death when taking discoveries and turning them into drugs. And that is tough because traditionally the NIH, it's changing, but it's mostly focused on basic research, not translational. They are moving more towards that. So, you know, at St. Louis University, you know, I try to be very creative, and you've heard of things like crowdsourcing and things. And if you can reach enough people, instead of having a huge donor that gives you $1 million, maybe you could have globally, you know, 100,000 people giving $10 and if they believe in your cause and think that you can do something.
Dr. Gutman, thoughts on that?
Right. I think the research funding really reflects the stage of the evolution of an idea. So this is all patient-directed research. In an early stage, it's very high risk, and that's not usually something the federal government feels comfortable. But that's where philanthropy can be quite beneficial. And then there's a stage where you need to move it from the idea as into a proof of concept and make it work, and that's the valley of death. And that may be a different source, private foundations, and then finally the NIH.
Well, you say finally the NIH, and the reason I brought that up was because of the situation the government is in today with sequestration and all the rest of it. There are just far fewer dollars for things such as this. And Pete, you're nodding your head quite actively there.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. It's a very, very tough environment, and I think you have to get creative. Where is the funding going to come from? And, you know, you hear all about in the news about this this growing disparity about the haves and the have-nots and concentrated at the top. And it's a way to get that concentration in the top to say, you know, here are ways you can give back. You know, there's lots of ways, but here are ways. And then trying to establish maybe better, more efficient mechanisms that are in place now to make that happen.
Right. Final thought for you, Doctor?
And a lot of this is going to be a team effort. And it's a team effort that involves families, scientists, and physicians all working together. And I think when we take that kind of approach, we can, you know, collectively, we can actually make a difference.
I'm going to turn back to Allison and Francis here for our final thoughts. Allison, you've been listening to all of this. What final thoughts do you have with regard to what you're hearing about the predicament that other people are in versus your own?
I say get checked as soon as possible because you never know what underlying cause that might be, and to really stay positive. I mean, I know it's very unpredictable what could happen, but as long as you do that, I think you'll be okay.
Francis, how about you? You take any hope from what you've heard today?
Well, Dr. Gutman gave me a lot of hope, you know, when I went to the clinic for the first time. You know, he gave me a protocol to go through. I mean, we did a lot of MRIs every 3 months, lots of blood tests, lots of kidney tests, lots of hearing tests, lots of eye tests. But when you follow the protocol and be compliant with it, you know, he's a good source and a good shoulder to cry on, you know,
well,
if you have a lot of questions. So
hold those tears. Hold on to the hope and forget about those tears, all right?
Absolutely.
I want to wish you and Allison the very best and continued success with treatments and have a long, prosperous, and wonderful life.
I want to say a shout-out to my son who's in the hospital right now.
Very quickly.
Yeah. We love you, and we're glad you're coming home.
That's Frances Wersch. Allison Wersch is with us, as is Pete Ruminski and Dr. David Gutman. I thank you all so much for being with us. Most informative conversation. Keep up the good work, gentlemen.
Thank you, ladies.
Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with a panel of legal experts. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.